ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. Today I have two books and two wonderful authors for you to meet, starting with a really gorgeous novel by the American writer Dave Eggers. Dave Eggers is a writer. He's also a visual artist. You might know him for his memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, or for his many novels, including The Circle and You Shall Know Our Velocity. Or maybe you know him for his children's books, or maybe you know him for his nonfiction, or maybe you know him as the founder of McSweeney's, the publishing house and literary journal. He's a very, very busy guy. So it's probably not surprising that his new book, it's called Contrapposto, it was two decades in the making. Contrapposto is about two friends in the American Midwest. They have big artistic dreams. Our main character, Cricket, wants to be a painter. And wonderfully, we actually get to see some of Cricket's work in this novel. His drawings are peppered through the pages of this book. And I've got to tell you, they pack a big emotional punch. Dave Eggers, welcome to The Book Show.
Hey, nice to be here.
The drawings were such a lovely surprise when they first appeared. Dave, are these your own work?
Those are credited to Cricket Dibb himself, our novel's hero, and that's all I'm going to say. I want to keep the illusion of, but I'm glad you like them. If anyone likes drawings of mostly nude people, that we have a bunch in this book, and just enough, I think. At least 12. So I think that that's sort of the minimum number of mostly nude people you should have in any literary novel.
It is perfect. You've been drawing for quite a long time, I take it, Dave.
Yeah, I have two things in common with Cricket. One, I grew up in the Midwest, and then two, I drew as a kid. I didn't pursue it as far as Cricket does, and so I do know a little bit about growing up and training as a, you know, getting classical and academic training as a draftsman. But everything else, I assure you, is fiction. And I always set the sort of parameters for everybody, because when they read Midwest and whatever, I think their brain starts going into that this is autobiography, or that terrible term autofiction. I don't know if you have it in Australia. It's such a horrific term for what used to just be called romana clef, or, you know, like just a novel. But now we have to come up with this term that makes it sound like you're writing about Chevy Malibus and muscle cars. It's such an ugly, ugly term. I don't know. This was not where we intended to go, Claire. I'm sorry that I keep hijacking this conversation and taking it into weird zones.
This is exactly what we like to do on The Book Show. And look, I promise I am not trying to turn Contrapposto into a piece of autofiction, autobiography, but I did want to talk about art for a moment more, Dave, because the drawings in the book are so gorgeous. Cricket is doing life drawing of people in the nude. Why is this such a special way to make art? What is that relationship like when there is someone being vulnerable and beautiful in front of you?
Have you done it yourself? Have you drawn from the nude model?
I can't even draw a stick person, Dave.
But I will tell you this. Like I learned, you know, at an academy, I could teach you or anybody to draw pretty competently in a few weeks. And it used to really be something that any kind of well-rounded education, you would learn how to draw what was in front of you. And that's why scientists used to, you know, Darwin's notebooks are full of beautiful drawings and, or, you know, competent drawings. And most scientists knew how to draw. And because you can learn it just like you learn grammar or just like you would learn basic notes on a piano. And so, but I think, you know, I started taking classes when I was young, drawing from the model, and we still do it here now. I'm at the McSweeney's offices as we speak, and we periodically will hire a model to come, and a bunch of us art school refugees that work here will draw with nothing at stake, and the drawings don't go anywhere. They stay in our notebooks, really. But I think it's a really almost otherworldly experience, even though it's very nature bound. You know, you have this human in front of you with all of their quirks and their unusual aspects of their bodies. Everybody's body is so drastically different, but really beautiful in their own way. And we prefer always hiring sort of older models that where their bodies have seen a few things and have grown into very, very specific shapes. And see, the first class I ever took, this older guy got out in front of us with a robe on, and I prayed to heaven that it would not be him, that this older man who seemed ancient and sickly and was probably going to have skin that looked like melted wax, I thought he was going to take off his robe and I would just be so disgusting. And, you know, looking back, the guy was probably exactly my age. Like he was, you know, I'm 56. This is how young I was and how old this model was. But then he dropped his robe and he looked very strong and vital still. And his skin was, I mean, the differences between a young man's body and his were just minute. And it was very affirming to know how little the body can change and how strong you can be and appear at any age. And so I always prefer to this day, like, you know, people that have lived a little bit, the body tells a lot of stories and those older models make the best models.
That's so wonderful to hear. Did I overstate it when I said at the top that Contrapposto was 20 years in the making?
No, it was probably more than that. So you didn't overstate it. If anything, I probably understated it myself when I've been saying that, because I went to art school for a half a minute. I was mostly a journalism major, but for a strange year, maybe I was a painting student. And so I think that this has been kicking around in my head ever since I left school. And I became an art writer for a while. I will not say art critic, because really all I did was sort of write about things I loved and shows that I loved and artists I loved. And so I was really not critical of and I don't see the point necessarily going to a obscure art show in a small struggling gallery and then committing critical violence against it in the local paper. So I sort of focused on things that I appreciated. But so I've been sort of skirting the art world more or less since I was in college. And I'm sitting here in our basement where we have a little printmaking studio where I make prints, and then we sell the prints to raise money for this the rent on this building, where upstairs we have what's called the International Library of Young Authors, which is books written by kids from all over the world, including two whole shelves dedicated to Australian young writers. So we sell the prints, help pay rent. And so my approach to art is very practical, I guess, very different than Cricket's, where he just cannot countenance even the smallest compromise and can't deal with the commercial side of the art world. And so he frustrates Olympia, who's always trying to drag him into that and professionalize him, where he's sort of a talented artist without any ambition or pragmatism, let's say.
He's a gorgeous, well, boy when we first meet him. We're going to follow him through a lifetime, really. But when we meet our protagonist, cricket. Should we say where the name comes from first? Because that's not his actual name.
Well, yeah, his name is Robert or Rob, but his mom, who's a single mom, has taken up with a terrible guy who also has the name Robert. And so Cricket's grandfather had nicknamed him Cricket because he sort of makes a chirping sound when he's busy drawing at his grandfather's feet. And so at a certain point when he realizes that he just can't stand having the same name as this man he loathes, he decides to be Cricket for the world, Cricket in public, Cricket always. And which is another thing that drives Olympia crazy, because it's not really a serious name for a serious artist. So later on, when she gives him a show in Chicago, she, without asking his permission, she changes his name to his middle name. So it's R. Silas Dibb, which she thinks sounds a little bit more appropriate for somebody trying to sell $1,000 paintings, you know?
I'd buy a painting from a guy called Cricket. But right. He's very talented, even as a child. And he dreams of being this great, I guess, kind of classical artist. And he has this beautiful, naive belief that maybe someone from Europe is just going to call him and he's going to be taken away to be an apprentice to a great master. Yeah. Is that something you can sympathize with, Dave?
Well, I think that he spends his lunch hours, you know, he works at a local sort of shop that's attached to the train station, and spends his lunch hours looking through art books and reading about Rembrandt, Caravaggio, and Hals, and artists of that era that were all apprenticed by 12 and 13. You know, their talent was recognized, or their parents wanted to, you know, give them opportunities with master artists. And so he doesn't know that this system has not been in place for 300 years, maybe. So his 16th birthday, he, as it approaches, he's just catastrophizing, because he thinks if he doesn't get whisked off to Amsterdam or Paris by 16, that'll be the end. And so, you know, he's a kid from rural Indiana, and he really has no exposure to any realities of the art world. And so this seems as likely as anything else. And so I like the fact that he's definitely born in the wrong century, because everything that he can do would be far more appreciated in, you know, 1630 than it is in 1980, when figurative art and classical techniques were really not in favor.
Mm. He has this incredible friend. Her name is Olympia. She's a year or so older than him, and I would say he is besotted with her from the moment he meets her. Can you tell us about that very first interaction that Cricket and Olympia have?
Well, she has noticed him in school as the kid that knows how to draw, or one of them. I think everybody always knows the kids that are in the back of the class drawing rockets or, you know, Led Zeppelin covers or whatever. And so she gives him his first public commission, which is to vandalize horribly and really, you know, X-ratedly a public play structure in their town. And she and her friend, older friend, another guy, give Cricket a number of sort of euphemisms for, can I say this on your radio, the word masturbation?
Is that okay? You can. Go for it.
So he doesn't know what any of these things mean. Some of them rhyme, but she tells him to do it, you know, in a beautiful, ornate, old English style with a magic marker, and he does that, and she's very impressed. And he's besotted is exactly the word, because first she's, you know, older and worldly and eloquent and beautiful, and two, she notices him. It's the first time a peer or anybody with any kind of authority, even the authority of a 10-year-old curator, has noticed him. So he's sort of devoted to her for the next 66 years. And she is always that person who champions him and sees potential in him where maybe few others do, and always trying to pull him out of obscurity and into a spotlight of some kind. And I think that even though she's never sure that he's her mate or the one. He's always ready to walk through that door if she opens it.
I love their dynamic. I mean, Olympia is such a force. I totally understand why Cricket is besotted. But I love the way that this friendship, despite all the things they will go through in their lives, it always remains pretty much the same as when they're about 10 years old. What was it you wanted to explore about these friendships that we have over a lifetime?
Well, I don't know about you, but I've found it hard to find novels that explore friendship the way that I guess I know it. You know, I've had the same friends since I was 10 and three even, you know, I'm thinking about it. My best friend from age three lives about 10 miles away from where I'm sitting right now. And, but I have all these other friends too. A lot of us from Chicago moved out to California. We've been here forever. And so I think when I turned 50, I'm 56 now, and I still had all the same friends. I knew this book would cover their whole lives, but I guess I'd never really 1,000% believe that you would have all the same friends all your life, you know, or that the friendship would change so little. And so when I turned 50 and I looked around and all the same people were in my life and they were all exactly the same in most ways, and we related to each other in the same way we did when we were in sixth grade, I thought, well, okay, well, I guess I don't have to do research on this. Something I kind of know. So even though it goes until they're 70 with Cricket and Olympia, like the way that they talk to each other has that same kind of conversational topspin that they develop in high school. And they know each other so well, in fact, that like, if anything, it's every so often they need time away so that they can, I guess, develop on their own and come back together and try to surprise each other or try to say I'm a new version of myself or I've evolved in some way. But at the core, they know each other too well, which is, I think, always the case with people that knew you when you were eight. Mm. You can't pull over much on them. And I think in a way you really don't want to. I just ran into a friend in Amsterdam last week who I hadn't seen in 10 years. And there was not more than a half a second before we were in the exact same conversational rhythm and, you know, than we had been the last time I'd seen him. And at that point, our kids were little. Now our kids are in college and there's just but everything that you loved about that person from the start, some symbiosis, some way of finishing each other's sentences, a way of seeing the world and affection that just is sort of only strengthened over decades that, I think that there's a reason why old friends keep us feeling strong and are so important to, you know, actual physical health. All of these scientists are always saying these old friendships help keep us feeling strong and feeling, and you live longer and you live happier, all of these things. And so they're worth fighting tooth and nail to maintain and, you know, flying across the world if you need to be there when they call.
Yeah. Dave Eggers, in Contrapposto, our artist Cricket has this kind of depressing habit of creating a piece of art, loving it before he goes to bed, waking up the next morning, looking at it again and going, what have I made? It's awful. I wanted to talk to you about that with this book, 20 years in the making, you make it. Can you look at it now and be proud of what you have made?
Well, sure. But, you know, it's not... What happens is with everything, with any book I've done, there's the moment in creation where you think you're doing something really great. You know, you end a day where you thought, oh, I put some good words together that day. And then very often the next day you'll reread what you wrote and it's utter garbage. And then that gets worse sometimes when you set it aside for months and you come back to an entire chapter or a passage or even, you know, large swath of a book and you realize it's not at all what you thought it was and your optimism was totally misguided. I think in particular with visual art, though, so much of it relies on chance, especially if you're doing figure drawing, like you might do 20 figure drawings in a 3-hour session. And usually they're like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And you'll just turn the page after one pose and, you know, you'll go back the next day like he does. He looks through his pad and to see what he's drawn the day or week before. And the things you thought worked didn't work. And then the drawings you thought were unsuccessful, suddenly there's something, you know, some kind of alchemy that happens where you captured something that you didn't even realize. It's almost like photography where you the photos that are usually the best are the more spontaneous and improvised rather than the ones that are studied and, you know, rehearsed. And so with visual art, it's really different. You can work and work a book over years and it won't show the work usually. But if you work and overwork a canvas, you can tell. You can't, so much of it relies on the luck of the first draft, you know, the capturing some gesture just right. And so he repeatedly has that experience where he goes to bed with this painting in the room that he's done, and he's just praying that in the morning it's as good as he thought it was when he closes his eyes. And there's a few times when he wakes up and it's as he remembered. And there's nothing better than that, because it's nothing that you labored or forced. It's really like you're channeling something. It's hard to say, hard to explain it without sounding very new agey and the universe did this for me or the universe told me that. But there is a real element of luck to say, okay, I captured something.
But the novel, you can put the hard yards into that. That can be more of a slog to get the result that you need.
Yes, but then there's still an element of chance. And I always tell this to like aspiring novelists, and so weird, but I ran into a guy I hadn't seen in 30 years on the street, like the second before I got on this call, and I hadn't seen him since 1993, and he's working on a book. And I was just trying to say, like, well, the alchemy between the author and the reader is really hard to predict whether something works or not. I've had books where I finished them and I thought they were very good. And then they don't at all connect with the reader. And it's impossible to predict. But I think that it's the same thing. There's an element of chance. There's something in the gap between the author and the reader that sometimes there's some kind of electrical spark that happens that you really can't foresee. In this book, it jumps ahead every 10 years or so. And I let the reader fill in the gaps. And I think there's great pleasure in doing that. And I love books that let the reader participate a bit and respects their own ability to fill in some of these things and make reasonable assumptions about what would have happened in between. And so this is all to say, like, it's the same thing. It's almost like cricket going to bed and waking up in the morning hoping it works. Sometimes you'll finish a book and you have no idea how that first reader will experience it, whether it will work or it won't. And I don't know of any writers that know if it'll work. You know, I think that there's really, it's continually a shock when that first reader will read it as you hoped that they would read it, would find joy in it the way that you hoped that they would, that they will finish it, which is also really good sign when your first friendly readers will actually finish the book in a timely way. For any aspiring writers out there, if you send your first or, you know, the novel you've got in your closet, if you send it to a trusted friend and it takes them 6 weeks to read it, then that's probably a bad sign. We've all experienced this. A book that works will usually be read in a short amount of time because the reader wants to keep turning pages. And we have to be good at listening to these sort of subtle hints that something is not quite working. I've learned in my vast experience to start really listening to those unspoken indicators that maybe it's not quite there.
Well, I adored this book. It made me cry. It's called Contrapposto. It's published by Canongate. Dave Eggers, what a pleasure to meet you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show. And now I'm taking you to a future world. And this is a world where, imagine the fog hanging low, cactuses running wild, and a mother and son living in an abandoned house far from town. This is the setting for The End of Romance, a dystopian novel by the Australian writer and poet Maria Takalander. Hi, Maria.
Hello.
Can you start by telling me when and where this novel is set?
Well, it's set in an uncertain time and place, but it is set in the future, and it is set in a place that's been devastated and denuded by the impacts of climate change.
So what would I see if I walked outside?
You would see mostly the wreckage of human lives, the wreckage of houses and all of their appliances and paraphernalia, all the rubbish that humans leave behind. But you'd also see survivor plants, cactuses and other hardy, prickly, unappealing plants that have managed to survive the tough conditions of a climate-changed future.
And a lot of fog, right?
Yes. So at this time of the year in which the novel is set, the city where the characters live is blanketed in fog during the winter. So visibility is poor, and I think that kind of ties in with maybe a theme of the novel related to how clearly we can see things.
Yeah. And I was looking and looking and looking for Australia when I read this novel, Maria, knowing that you are Australian, but it's not necessarily somewhere in this country, right?
No, that's right. I mean, climate change is a global problem. So in that regard, I wasn't attached to portraying what it's like in one particular corner of the world. However, fun fact, I did have in mind, for some reason, Lima, which is the capital of Peru, because I remember when I was there that that particular city is blanketed by fog for a portion of the year because it's in between the sea and the mountain ranges of the Andes. So, and it also has very arid landscapes. So, fun fact.
I feel like I've got the insider goss on this novel now. This is excellent. I guess the other thing when you're walking around this landscape is it seems like there aren't as many people about as there once was. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. So population is far less dense in this imagined future, owing mostly to a certain development. So humanity has discovered another planet, a so-called mirror Earth, that it's trying to reach and colonise as its only hope for having a future, given what's happened to the Earth. So half of the population, the half made up of men, are being conscripted and sent there to fight this colonising battle.
And of course, this is such a contemporary idea, Maria. You know, we know that there are people looking at ideas for maybe a colony on the moon, maybe a colony on another planet in the real world. What is your take on this? Does this seem like a good idea to you?
Well, actually, when I started this novel, I was very aware of Elon Musk's plan at that time to have a human colony on Mars by 2026. So we're in 2026 now. He hasn't managed to fulfil that particular ambition, but he is looking towards the moon and still ambitious about colonising Mars. So these kinds of ideas are definitely in the air. And for me, it's a hugely problematic ambition to set our sights on living somewhere else, because it then takes the pressure away from looking after where we live now. I mean, the earth is where we've evolved. It's our natural home. So it strikes me as a bizarre development that we wouldn't feel a sense of care and duty towards that home, but instead look elsewhere as if other places are viable options.
It kind of taps into that human instinct to throw away the old and just go find something new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and there is a lot of cast-off rubbish in this world that I've portrayed in the novel. So maybe that's that idea comes through there as well. But it also, Musk's way of thinking, Musk's plan to colonise another world, resonated for me with stories from religions, which imagine a better place, a paradise, a refuge somewhere else, you know, some version of heaven, somewhere better than the earth. You know, my mind kind of balks at that idea that, you know, we are living on the most miraculous planet. If we look around space, if we look around the universe, it's extraordinary that we have this home here to live on, that sustains us, that gives us everything we need. And yet we're constantly, it seems to me, looking for somewhere else.
So obviously Elon Musk was on your mind, climate change was on your mind. What else were you thinking about when things started to stir for this novel, The End of Romance?
I mean, pretty much I'm the woman that you'll read about in the first pages of the novel, which is a mother lying in bed in the early hours of the morning worried about her son. And that was very much my position when I started this novel. I was worried about, obviously, the future of the planet, which looks like becoming uninhabitable for a lot of species in the not-too-distant future. So I was worried about the kind of environment into which my son would become an adult, but I was also worried about the world of men into which my son will inevitably grow, and which is, you know, defined to some degree by the manosphere and ideas of, you know, toxic masculinity and masculinity associated with conquering planets and conquering people. So, I mean, all of these things play through your mind when you're the mother of a young son, just wondering what kind of world of men is my son growing into.
And when you have all those worries that are keeping you awake at night, does writing a novel help in any way?
Does writing a novel help? I don't know if it helps, but it gives you a way to imagine and explore your anxieties. And I think, you know, for me, come to a stronger understanding of what it is to be a mother, what it is to have a son, and the intensity of that relationship. So, you know, all of those things can be explored, I suppose, in a way that you wouldn't think about them in ordinary life.
Can you introduce me to the main character in The End of Romance? She doesn't have a name, but she's a mum. She's worried about her kid. Who is this person?
She's a mother faced with the extraordinary challenge of keeping herself and her son alive in a hostile environment. And she's also faced with the prospect of her son being sent to military school at the age of 8. So he has to go to military school to be trained up to become part of the military force that's being sent to colonise this new planet. So she knows that she's going to lose her son to the army and to this mission, and they're things that she's had no say over. They're things that the boy has had no say over. And she becomes kind of desperate to find a way to keep the child with her and therefore to somehow escape this fate that has been allotted to both of them.
When this boy goes off to military school, he has this certain uniform he has to wear. I don't know why I found this particular part of the book so distressing. Maria, the uniform that the kids wear, what do they have to wear to school?
Yeah, so the uniform is distressing because it basically masks their humanity. So the boys, when they start attending military school, are clad head to toe in a white boiler suit, a black balaclava and black boots. So, yeah, it's very much about masking their humanity because in that military environment, they're, of course, taught necessarily to deny their humanity because ultimately they're going to be compelled to kill.
There's a third key character in this book. There's a man who this woman comes across early in the novel, and he seems to have managed to grow up in this world and not get sent away. What do we need to know about this man?
Yes, so the woman comes across this young man who miraculously, it seems to her, hasn't been sent away. So he's somehow avoided being sent to military school. He's not wearing a uniform. He's dressed in regular clothes like she is, and he's obviously avoided being sent away to fight the colonising war because all of the boys are sent away when they're 16, and this young man is older than that and miraculously still around. And so he becomes a pivotal character for her because she wants to find out how it is that he's managed to survive and stay on the earth, and she's very keen to unlock his secrets.
Maria Chakalanda, you've published poetry before. You've published a collection of short stories. How long have you worked on this novel?
This novel has been a long time in the work, so I probably was writing it for about 8 years.
Wow.
So it was very much a labour of love. It became something of an obsession and I poured a lot into it.
The title of this novel, The End of Romance, seems kind of incongruous with what's inside the book. Can you tell me where the title came from?
If the title hails the end of romance, I think in some ways it's to put the focus on the importance of love.
Mm.
So maternal love, most obviously, because the central relationship in the novel is between a mother and her child, but also platonic love. The woman and the man do form a friendship or a partnership of sorts. But there's also biophilia, love of life, terophilia, love of the earth. There's the love of fellow human beings promoted by the Gospels, for instance. There's erotic love. I mean, love is such an extraordinary and complex emotion or condition. And I'm not sure that romance does it justice. Mm. I think romance as a sentimental version of love can kind of flatten out the full experience of love and even at some level deprive it of its complexity and profundity.
So this might be a world where there's no time for romance, but there is always time for love.
Absolutely. That's beautifully put. And, you know, I'm very aware, even as I say that, that, you know, if we think about romance as a story, as human beings, we're very much in need of stories. This woman tends to live at the level of brute reality. Her concern is with survival. She doesn't understand why her son loves stories about, you know, talking animals and other worlds. They're very different in that way. And of course, the mother has to focus on the survival, and the child is enabled to indulge in stories because she's looking after everything for him. And I think to exist at the level of this woman, at the level of brute reality and survival, is very difficult to do. I think we do need to soften the blow of reality to some degree by indulging in stories, but then it becomes about what kind of stories are useful stories to tell, particularly in our current time, particularly as we're faced with climate change, particularly as we're faced with the end of a livable world as we know it. What kind of stories do we want to tell? Do we want to indulge in romances? Do we want to indulge in fantasy? Or would we be better off starting to tell stories that connect us to the earth, that foster a sense of care in us when it comes to the earth?
So much to think about. The book is called The End of Romance. It's published by Text. Maria Takalanda, it's been great to meet you today.
Oh, it's been great to chat about the novel. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for the book show today. The novels you heard about were Contrapposto by Dave Eggers and The End of Romance by Maria Takalanda. Thank you to the book show's producer, Sarah Lestrange. Sarah and I make the book show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. My name is Claire Nichols. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.